Today's daf in Masechet Sukkah, brought to you from Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh, is daf Chof Dalet. We had gotten a bit ahead over here, and we got up to Velo Chayish Rabbi Yehuda Lemita. So remember what we were talking about was the question of why it was that Rabbi Yehuda had said to Rabbi Meir that Shema Yibaka Hanot. Mashma that Rabbi Yehuda was the one that was more Chayish for Misa. And yet over here, we found that by the Sukkah, we were trying to explain that Rabbi Meir has an objection to utilizing a Baal Chai for a Mechitza, because maybe it will die. So that seems to be the opposite of Rabbi Yehuda's Chashash of Shema Yibaka Hanot. So we explained that actually Rabbi Yehuda is not Chayish for Shema Yibaka Hanot, and that there's because of that, The way that we had it originally, that Abaye answered the contradiction, was the opposite of the way that we had thought, and that the real raya was from our Mishnah, and that the issue over there with the Yayin Mibein HaKutim was actually a question of whether we hold of Brera or we don't hold of Brera. So the last thing that we learned yesterday was that according to Rabbi Yehuda, there is no chashash of Mita, and according to Rabbi Meir, there is a chashash of Mita, and that that was the reason that we had this machlokas over here about using a Baal Chai for a mechitza. The problem tonight is that it seems that it is not true that Rabbi Yehuda holds we're not chayish lemita. Velo chayish Rabbi Yehuda lemita. So here were three lines beneath the middle of the page. Velo chayish Rabbi Yehuda lemita. How can you say that Rabbi Yehuda is not concerned with the possibility of death? Doesn't it say in the Mishnah we just had in Yoma that Tanan Rabbi Yehuda Omer Afi Shah Cheret Matkinin Lashem Atamut Ishto? That the whole idea over there was when we're mafresh the Kohen Gadol mi Beisai, and we make sure that we have another Kohen that was monui tachtov to be able to take his place in case he becomes nifsal. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, we even take another wife for him because it says v'chiper ba'ado ba'ad beito, and if he wouldn't have a wife, he wouldn't be able to do the kapar of Yom Kippurim. So we prepare also another wife for him. So that means that the Chacham said, well, we're going to have to be chashish that his wife is going to die. Shema tamut ishto. That's like very far-fetched. So there it's Dafka Rabbi Yehuda who says that we are chashish, and it's Rabbi Meir who says we aren't chashish. So like wherever we look, we have these contradictions. So why does Rabbi Yehuda over there chayish for an isha acheret matkin lino shema tamut ishto? Says the Gemara, but don't you remember how we came out over there? That because actually, as the Gemara pointed out, that the Tanakhama says to Rabbi Yehuda, I mean, so then, how do you know that the second wife won't die? In other words, once you're already being chayshish lamisa, so then maybe the next one will die. Im kenei l'dover seif. And we answered over there that the entire question over here was not a serious chashash. It was that we were trying to be making these special ma'alot that people should understand how much we're makbid on the kapora of Yom HaKippurim, and therefore we do whatever we can do to make a ma'alah b'kapora. It's not that we really think we're handling all the bases and so on. We're not looking to handle all the bases. All that we're trying to do is to give over the sense of the desperation and the chashivas of the inyan of kapora's Yom HaKippurim. So therefore, that also explains why it would appear that over there, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda is chayish l'misa, because it doesn't mean that he's really chayish l'misa. It means that we're looking for an ability to make a mala in the inyanim of kapara. Anyway, but listen, bottom line is, there's a very serious problem in all of the discussion that we had here, because neither approach really properly explains what it is that Rabbi Meir said. Because the problem would be that if Rabbi Meir is telling me that all of this is because of this gezeira, I don't care what the gezeira is, whether it's like a buyer like Rabbi Zera, whether it's like a buyer who says that we're afraid it'll die, or whether it's Rabbi Zera, we're afraid that maybe it'll run away. But what does that mean? That means that lemaisa from the tzad of the diraisa, this is a perfectly valid mechitza. That's what you're saying, right? So then there's no way to explain Rabbi Meir, because bein leman diomer shema tamut, bein leman diomer shema tivrach. What you're saying is that midioraita, it's perfectly okay to have a mechitza that's a Baal Chai. And the only problem is that the Rabbanim goes there, we don't want you to get into a position where you won't have a sukkah kshera, either because it ran away or because it died, whatever. So then how do you explain the fact that it says, and we saw this before, except here it's a Mishnah, we'd rather bring it from the Mishnah, but it said it beferish in the Braita that we brought, as Tosfos points out. I mean, the idea over here is that Rebbe Meir also says that it's not a golel for a kever, right? So it says beferish there in the Mishnah, lamatan Rebbe Yehuda mitamei mishum golel, that this animal is considered to be a proper deraisa defined cover for a kever, and therefore it will be mitame. And Rebbe Meir's mitayer. How could the Rabbana make a kula on the deraisa? It doesn't make any sense. If Rebbe Meir is saying that it doesn't serve as a deraisa covering of a kever, then obviously he's not talking about a gzera de Rabbanan. The Rabbanan are not going to be mekel. So therefore, what is Rebbe the real svara of Rebbe Meir? It cannot be a gezer de Rabbona. So what is it? Says Gemara, you're right. Forget this entire discussion. It's not because of gezer de Rabbonan. It is a svara that we met before when we were learning Erevin, and that is Elam Revacha Bar Yaakov. The real issue over here is that Kasava Rebbe Meir kol mechitza she'omedet baruach ina mechitza. That if something is not able to stand on its own, then that means we don't view something that has no actual physical presence that we can touch. We don't view that as a mechitza. So the fact is that an animal is not a mechitza. Tell me how it is that it's standing. Show me how it's standing. It's standing basically by this indefinable breath of life. The moment you take away that breath of life, this thing is just a glob of protoplasm. So how is a glob of protoplasm a mechitza? Show me what's holding it up. Show me what makes it a mechitza. Therefore, Rebbe Meir holds, it's something that's intangible, and its very intangibility disqualifies it from a mechitza. That is the real issue. Whereas others say that what Rav Acha Bar Yaakov said was, it's not because of its intangibility. It's because of the fact that it cannot be made by a human. So therefore, the point over here is that a mechitza she'ena asuya bidei adam. If it's something, it doesn't mean that it has to be asuya literally bidei adam. Obviously, I mean, we spoke about plenty of cases where you're using the side of a valley as a mechitza. I mean, it's what he means is that if we cannot actually define, it's got to be something that has a physical presence that a human would be able to achieve. Okay, you as a human being cannot actually duplicate the breath of life. That's like some type of strange emergent quality from all of its physical interrelationships. You can't duplicate that. Since you can't duplicate it, that's the point that it does not, it's not its tangibility qua tangibility. It's its physicality in terms of the way we usually view physicality, which is our ability to interact with it. And one thing we do not have ability to interact with is life itself. There's nothing we can do to bring this thing back to life or to give it life and so on. And therefore, as a mechitza, it's viewed to be standing by magic. And in that sense, it's not the norm of a mechitza. Is there a difference between the fact that it's intangible or the fact that it's an intangibility that's emergent? Of course there is. Because, I mean, let's say that you would use a balloon. So you have this gigantic balloon that you blow up and you make each wall a different balloon. Very colorful sukkah, adorable. A balloon sukkah. Kids will love it. So can you make a balloon sukkah? Well, that's the question. The balloon is a ruach. The thing is, it's just good old-fashioned gas, and you can definitely be show late on gas. I mean, unless you're going to tell me that. No, it's the actual intangibility of the gas in that I don't really see it and I don't feel it directly, only if there's a tremendous amount of it and it's blowing and so on. Okay, that's the problem. So then the balloons wouldn't be good. So liman diyam mechitza omedet beruach ena mechitza. Okay, balloons basically are gas, and therefore they're omedet beruach. But if the problem is that that's not an issue, so gas is a little bit less tangible than liquid. I mean, come on. The issue is that it's not part of the normal way in which you interrelate with the physical universe. You relate with it just in terms of simple cause and effect. I mean, you could blow up a balloon, for God's sake, so that's simple cause and effect. So if the problem is that it's ena asuya bidei adam, This is perfectly us. So yeah, but they had them go next door, get their flower shop, and have them blow it up with their little helium, or just use, you know, not the floating balloon, whatever. But anyway, that would be the nafkamina of the halachas, the halachic approach to something that is, I mean, the ruach. What we actually mean is that the adam aspect of the ruach. Anyway, getting up just to the end, we mentioned over there, which this isn't really nogea ar sugi, but once we brought it up, let's take a look at that. Because you said over there that according to Rabbi Yossi Aglili, Mishum Rabbi Yossi Aglili Amrum, once we're talking about a living animal, you should know that you're not allowed to write a get for a woman. So you can't divorce a woman writing the get on an animal. My time with Rabbi Yossi Aglili, what is the problem? The Tanya, it says in the Torah, the katavla sefer kiritut. So a katavla sefer kiritut means that it has to be, at least on the surface, an actual sefer. Now, a sefer, as described in the Torah, is something that's actually made of parchment. So it would have to be written on the skin of an animal. How do I know that I could use a piece of paper, or I could use a leaf for that matter? Talmud Lomar, Vikatavla, since it says Vikatavla, so the idea over here, if it would just be, I need to give her a sefer kritut, so then fine, so you could just say Vinatanla sefer kritut, right? Because if a sefer by definition means a parchment on which the divorce is written, so then obviously it needed to be written. I mean, who wrote it? That's a given. Is it katav instead of Vikatav, Vinatan? How do I know, therefore, that I could use anything, not just a sefer, anything that I write on? Vikatavla, the point is, write it. So take a piece of paper and write it. Ah, so you'll say, so what is the point of saying sefer? That is coming to tell me a halacha. And Tosfos points out that in reality, what we're dealing with over here, even though the Gemara doesn't say it openly, but he brings other places where that's also true, is we're dealing with a klal prat uklal. So since it says that the vikatavla, which is a klal, anything, and then it says sefer, and then it says vinatan biyada. So that vinatan biyada, whatever it is another klal. So therefore it's a klal prat or klal, and it has to be similar to the prat. So just like the prat, ma sefer, davar she'in bo ruach chayim ve'ino ochel. So basically when we're talking about this sefer, it's certainly not a living thing. It's certainly not something that you eat. So af kol davar she'in bo ruach chayim ve'ino ochel. So it has to be similar to that. And therefore, if it's a living animal, it's excluded because of a klal prat or klal. Okay, so this is the d'oraisa that Rabbi Yossi actually was samech on. So wait a minute. So how did the Rabbanan, who did not agree, I mean, over there, the Tanna Kamma says it doesn't matter. You can use a get that's written on, there it's talking about an olive leaf. But, I mean, the point is that it is definitely considered to be Eichel, and it doesn't fit the Klal Prat Klal over here. So the Rabbanan say, look, if the Pesuk had said that you should write a Kritut Ba-Sefer, okay, so then fine, I'd say you're 100% right. Ba-Sefer, to write it in a book, that it would have to be in a book, which would define it as parchment, and then we would have to make our klal prat klal this way, but it doesn't say anything like that. It says sefer kritut. The sefer kritut means something which has a narrative. So what it's coming to tell me is that what you need to do is write the nature of the meaning of divorce. Right? You have to write into it, areat muteret l'chol adam. You write what it is that it's about. That's what it means. So this is sefer in the sense of narrative. Svirut dvarim ba'amahu da'ata. Because if it was coming to discuss the way in which you have to write it, so then it would say, put it ba'sefer. But that's not the point. The point is, write her a narrative. So then, if that's the case, why do I have to write the narrative? I don't understand. I mean, obviously, if we're talking about this narrative, right, so then if it doesn't have to say vikatav at all, because there's nothing there that tells me, listen, you're limited in what you can use as a medium. There's no limitations what I could use as a medium, right? As long as it's something that is able to be handed over into her hand and that contains the narrative. The medium is not important. So then why do I need to know that it has to be vikatavla? I understand, according to Rabbi Yossi, that's coming to tell me, even if it's paper, as opposed to parchment. Fine. But, I mean, the Rabbanan don't need that, because there was never any tzad to say that it would be limited to a piece of parchment anyway. Ah, says the Gemara, that's a whole different thing. That vikatavla is coming to tell me that the only way to effectuate a divorce is through writing. And there is no other modality. So, because why would I think that there was a modality? It's coming to tell me, b'ktiva mitgareshet ve'ina mitgareshet b'kesef. Let's say, can you divorce a woman with money? Can you give her money and say, okay, this money is the sign of our divorce. Here, go out and buy yourself a cup of coffee. So, advisedly. No, really, we'll see in a minute why I had to say that. Okay. Because Salka Daita Chamina, you might have thought, since it says, V'yatz'a mibeto, she should leave his home, V'alcha v'ayta le'ishacher. And then she goes and becomes, what do you mean becomes? That's a lotion of Kedushin. Havaya is a lotion of Kedushin. So how can you effectuate Kedushin? By money. You give her a ring, right? Or you give her money. So therefore, I would have thought it's a hekesh. Hov is kish yitzia la havaya. Since there is a hekesh that the Torah is making from v'yatzam mibeto v'halcha v'ayta le'ishacher, it's telling me that the modalities are similar. And in the same way that you can use money to effectuate a marriage, you can use money to effectuate a divorce. And therefore, Mahavaya Bekesev Af Yetziyah Bekesev comes along, the Torah, to write Vikatavla, only writing her is going to do the trick, not giving her the cup of coffee. Now, why do I say the cup of coffee? Because it's an obvious problem that Rishonim raised. Why didn't the Gemara ask whether you could be Megarish with Bia? There's Kesev, Shtar, and Bia. So over here, you're just going to say, maybe we should have one last fling, you know? And that's a sign of a divorce. So, I mean, the answer is obvious, that the nature of a divorce is to be mitrachek from one another, and the nature of bia is to be mitkarev one to the other. It doesn't make sense. I'm going to take something which is ipso facto a kirva and say, here is a sign of our imminent divorce. I mean, what sense does that make? So you could ask the same thing about kesef. I'm giving her a diamond ring, you know. So how exactly is that going to affect the divorce? That's why I say that in terms of the Yisrachkus, there's always this, it's not begetter the last fling. It's begetter, listen, you know, you have to take care of yourself now. Go ahead, here's some money. Go get yourself a cup of coffee, you know, and find yourself a new life. So in that sense, it does make some level of, in terms of a hekesh, to say I should be able, if it wouldn't be for the Torah's writing v'kasevla, I would think that maybe there actually is a way to do that. Therefore, I need to say v'kasevla, that even b'kesev is not going to work, only b'ktiva. So now, Rabbi Yossi Aglili, however, he can't learn that from here, right? Because he needs the v'kasev to tell me that you're allowed to use paper. So what does he do about this question? Can you or can you not utilize money to divorce? No, that, he says, I learned that also from another thing. Because forget about, you're right about the Vikasavala and so on, but does it not say Sefer Kritut? Okay, well, why does it say Sefer Kritut? Because the point over here is that the Sefer is the Kritut. That's what the Torah is coming to tell me. And that if you try to achieve the kritut by giving money, that's not kritut. So meanwhile, I learn out from the fact that next to the word safer, I make it, the safer is the kritut, it's being mamayit, any other form that you might try to use for kritut. And therefore, from there I know, safer korta, ve'in davar acher korta. No, oh, wait a minute now, so hold on, so then that means that the Rabbanan could also have used it for that. So now we're back to our problem. So then what happened to the Vikasavla? We're over there that only Ksiva is Megarish over here. It says Sefer Kritut. That's enough of a riot, right? Only a Sefer is Megarish and not money. So then now I need to explain again. So then what did the Rabbanan do with this Sefer Kritut? The Idach. So the Rabbanan, what did they do? Ahumi Boile. Let me just, Parnea is going to come in a minute. I'm going to be finished. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam shakol nieh bidvaro. So that, say the Rabbanan, you know, I need that to tell me that the type of document is not just a narrative about what I'm trying to do. It has to actually be a description of a true state of cutting the bonds. Kritut means to cut. And therefore, if I try to have strings attached, then those strings do not cut the relationship between us. That's where it comes, this whole idea. Correct, you have to cut through all of the strings. So what would be a string attached? Oh, so that's like the Braita says. Let's say a guy gives a woman a divorce on condition that she's never allowed to drink wine. He's obviously had some problems with the housewife's disease, right? But anyway, so he gives her this divorce on condition that she doesn't drink wine again. Or maybe he's got some problems with his father-in-law, you know. So I'm giving you this divorce on condition that you never visit your father. So if he makes this a condition, which is a permanent condition, and he says, olam, unlimited in time, your whole life what? That means your whole life you're going to be tied to me, right? Because I'm going to actually dictate the conditions of your life. And if you want this divorce to be chal, so then you can't go visit your father. That's not a divorce. Because then he's basically controlling her life. How is that kritut? So that's what we learn from there. It has to be a narrative of actual kritut. If he says for 30 days, okay, fine. Then it doesn't matter whether they have 30 days left in this world or not. That's not the point. The point is that this is something that is not defining her life. So it's just an ancillary condition, which may or may not define her life, but that's irrelevant, because that would be coincidentally ended up defining her life because she was hit by a car 3 weeks later, whatever, right? But that's not relevant to the get. So if he says kosher lo shimyon, so then the get is chal right now. Fine. So now, okay, that's a very good point. So now how does Rabbi Yossi HaGlili have Sefer Kritut free? Because he needed Sefer Kritut to tell me the idea that only a sefer is korta, but not the money from the hekesh. So now he's got to use this to tell me that you're not allowed to make a permanent condition, which would end up not being real kritut. So now he can't use it for only the sefer is korta. So now we're going to go all the way back. So that means he would have to use v'kotav law, but if he's v'kotav law, then he doesn't have the right that you can use a piece of paper and so on and so forth, right? So he's got to explain where he would know this halacha. Oh, this is very simple. If that's all that we wanted to know, okay, it could have said sefer karet. So sefer karet means the sefer actually achieves the karet, nothing else. So you write sefer kritut, you're telling me more. You're telling me that it's not just that the sefer achieves the karet, it's that it must be true absolute karet. It must be cutting yourselves off from each other. So therefore, I know both things. V'idach, karet kritut, lo darshe. Masha ein kein, the rabbanan hold, okay, I don't see that as being two separate drashot. That's all basically one idea. And now, we can't have our kapitan, but we can have our malava malka host. And therefore, we turn to Doc, who you understand in accepting this job has also accepted that he's our Malava Malka host, right? Because otherwise, why did he respond? So go for it, Doc. Somebody now makes a sukkah, and that sukkah is between a bunch of trees. And he uses the trees only as walls. Doesn't he? He makes a frame, puts up a sukkah, but he's got these trees all around the sukkah. Doesn't have any walls. So then it's kosher because, again, in the Mishnah before, we said that there's a problem. That's because the schach was dependent on the trees. And that's because the walls were basically not. Either we had the walls that were not kavua because they were the kroy hamitar or so on. But over here, what's the problem? You have a frame, and you have walls, and you have permanent schach, and it relates directly to the ground underneath it, so it's kosher. Omer v'achor bar Yaakov. So really, what issue does this even introduce, this Mishnah? I mean, it seems rather obvious based on everything that we had. Omri Vacha Bar Yaakov, well, here's where we have the problem. Since Rav Acha Bar Yaakov said that Kol Mechitza She'ina Yecholah La'amod Beruach Metzuya Eina Mechitza, so if the Mechitza itself is movable because of the wind, then it's not considered to be a Mechitza. Because since it is so weak that even the standard ability to stand up to normal air that's outside is considered to be not a Mechitza at all. And therefore, the problem is, in that case, we've got a problem with the Mishnah, no? I mean, trees generally will sway back and forth. So what would be the explanation of the Mishnah? If it says house, it's not. How it says sukato bena ilanot, vahilanot tifanotla kishera. But according to Rav Acha Bar Yaakov, why? Vahaka'azivate, it's moving back and forth in the wind, isn't it? No, we're talking about over here the trunks, the kashin, it's very hard. You're talking about a big tree, and the trunk of the tree covers the wall. That tree ain't going nowhere. And so because of that, it's kosher. Well, I mean, that's not what the Mishnah says. I mean, the Mishnah says that you can use a tree as the walls of a sukkah. I mean, that doesn't say you can only use the trunk of a tree. So, I mean, what about if you're next to a bush? You know, it's got a lot of leaves and everything, and it's got these thin branches, and every time the wind blows, it moves back and forth and so on. I mean, the Mishnah doesn't say that's not good. So, how can you say that that's the only meaning? I mean, va'ika nofo. I mean, certainly the Mishnah is covering a case where you are going to be using the nof. Well, if that's the case, then what Rav Acha Bar Yaakov would insist is that you've got to be dealing with the issue of the movability separately. Now, so what you can do is, I mean, you can make it more strong against the wind, stronger against the wind, by putting in other, like, branches that you take off from a palm tree or daphna for the bay leaf, which also has, like, a lot of thick leaves and so on. So, okay, so that must be what it's talking about, in which case it then becomes strong enough to not be considered movable in a Ruach Metzuya. Now, we're going to have to tomorrow talk about what exactly that's supposed to mean. I mean, what is considered to be movable? Like, just it like moves back and forth? Does it have to be like lifted out of the way? Does it have to go lamala mishlosh tefachim? I mean, certainly you're not going to be able to be oker this thing. I mean, it's going to be there. Even if you didn't put anything there, it's just going to move back and forth. I mean, what about if you use canvas or a sheet as a wall? If you use canvas and a sheet, it moves back and forth. How much moving back and forth are we talking about will make it possible as a mechitza? Does it actually need to be exposed to wind? Or what if it's like protected from the wind by something else? So then, or is it just the theoretical moving back and forth in the wind? All of these issues are, of course, very, very nogea lahalacha. And we'll get to them, Bezrat Hashem, tomorrow. But anyway, so it's got to be talking, according to Rav Acha Bar Yaakov, that you actually stiffened it. And you stiffened it by utilizing these strong branches. So I understand. So what's the chiddush? So then you're just describing a normal sukkah. What do I care what it's made out of? We never had a problem of having normal mechitzas that are made out of any material in the world. Didn't matter if it was Kabbal Tuma, it meant nothing. I mean, so why all of a sudden are we concerned? Oh, no, actually, it's not really telling us anything about the mechitzas. Ma de teima nigza dimati lishtamusha be'ilan. This is a continuation of the sugi we had before. Sugi we had before was talking about you can't go up on the tree because we have the gezera. So this is just basically expanding on that idea. But don't think that if you're not actually dependent on the sukkah, so then, well, I mean, look, I am dependent on the sukkah. I just don't have to touch it because it's on the ground. Yes, but still, you know, it's very likely that you'll take your cholent pot and you'll put it on top of the old willow tree while you're getting into the sukkah for a minute, right? So instead of taking everything to the table, you take it out of the kitchen and you just put it on top of the tree for a minute, which is the wall. And then you bring everything together and bring it inside. So maybe you'll end up using an ilan, and we don't want you to be mishtamish b'ilan. And therefore we said, listen, don't use an ilan for your walls either. Kamashmalan, that's not a gezera. Only the actual aliyah to the sukkah. And then the question whether you need a sukkah, that's really a shiva and the machlokas we had, but nothing more than that. Well, let's just see whether Rav Acha Bar Yaakov is really right about this, because there's lots of other things besides a sukkah that require a mechitza. And according to Rav Acher bar Yaakov, if you're going to be using this movable material in the wind, it's not going to be a kosher mechitza for whatever. So how about the case that we had about Pasei Beiraot? Remember, the Pasei Beiraot are the diumdin, where you have on all sides, you have a diu amud, right? Or you could have one piece, which is an amma by an amma, but you have it on all four sides, and it's for purposes of getting water out of a well for your animal on Shabbos, and for the tzarche of the olam regolim, they remater these diumdin. So suppose you make a diumad out of a tree. You know, you have like a bush. So you've got this bush, which is an amma by an amma, perfectly natural size for a bush. So could you use the bush as a diumdin? So it says in the Braita that if you have a bush or a stone, a gader is always made out of stones, as Rashi points out, you've got this stone wall, which is usually an amma by an amma, or even if you've got a mechitza zakanim, you've got like a little bit of bamboo, you know, that's made in this diumad. That's perfectly okay. Nidon mishum diumad, and that's all right. Now, what about, I don't get it. I mean, the answer is blowing in the wind. And according to this, Rav Acher bar Yaakov is being matir it anyway, right? How can he do that? It's going to be, I mean, how can you use the bush? It's a diyumden. No, must be talking about Dovah the Bhutz Bedafna. He means that it needs to, you need to sturdy it. That's weird. Okay, what about this brisa? Suppose you have a weeping willow. So now, if you have a weeping willow, you've got an interesting situation, because now the tree forms a tent all around itself, right? Because now the leaves come all the way down to the ground. So basically, you have this fabulous cathedral that has been made for you from the tree. Okay, so what's the din? Because it says over there that if you have an ilana mesach al ha'aretz, so now you've got this massive canopy from the leaves of the tree, comes all the way down to the ground, or at least within three tvachim. Im eino fog avom in ha'aretz shlosha tvachim. So basically, what do you have? You have a completely enclosed chutzer. Fantastic. So you should be able to carry inside that tree as if it's a shusha yachid, right? And that indeed is what it says. Metaltalin tachtav. You're allowed to carry on Shabbos. Ask the Gemara. But again, according to Rav Acher bar Yaakov, certainly those leaves are going to be moving back and forth in the wind, and therefore it shouldn't be a kosher mechitza. But he'll have to say the same thing over there. Hatam nami David lebutz v'dafna. There you made it stronger by stiffening materials. Ah, knew you would say that, and now I gotcha. Because if you stiffened it by adding these materials, then you run into another problem. Because then that means that you made it. But if you made it, then there's no size limitations, right? Something that is formed by nature. So we said you only have up to Beit Sa'atayim to carry it. Once it hits Beit Sa'atayim, it gets a din of a Carmelite, and therefore you won't be able to carry outside of your Arba Amot. So now, if you claim that you stiffened the willow tree over here, so then basically you built something for purposes of Dira. And remember, that was our big sugya back in Erevin. Is it hukaf l'dira or is it not hukaf l'dira? If it's not hukaf l'dira initially, so then you're limited to Beit Sa'atayim. But if it's hukaf l'dira, you're not limited. So now you're telling me you stiffened it. Ah, so okay, so then it was hukaf l'dira. How do you explain the fact that ihachi, if that were the truth, then nitalta bakule? Why can't I carry it inside of it, no matter how big it is? How do you explain the fact that Rav Huna bar Rav Yeshua said, but of course you would not be allowed to carry under the old willow over here if it's larger than a Beit Sa'atayim? Why not? Because it's not Ukaf Ladira, but you said you have to strengthen it, so it is Ukaf Ladira. So now I got you backed into a tree. So what are you going to do with this? Answers the Gemara, because you forgot that hukaf l'dira has got to be for a normal dira. But since the point of this dira is that nobody's going to live in this for purposes of having the house under the old willow, They'll live in it for purposes of allowing them to be outdoors. So a guy wants to be camping out or whatever. Fine, so he wants to be outdoors. That's basically a dirash tashmisha la'avir. The main point of this is to allow me to be outside of it, not to be inside of it. I'm going to be moving into this tree. So what I need to do is I need to be there in order to camp out, or I need to be there in order to do some hunting. So this is my hide, or I need to be there in order to be a shomer on the peros that are in the field outside. Okay, that's called a dira shetashbisha la'avir. The chol dira shetashbisha la'avir ein metantelim bo elasa ta'im. And we said that we have this gezera about an area that was hukaf ladira. If it isn't hukaf ladira, then the Carmelite kicks in at Beit Sa'ataim. When we said hukaf ladira, which was the Rabbanan definition of where they're making that gezera, it was for a real dira that you're going to be living in. That's the meaning of hukaf ladira. But to say that I'm still outdoors does not change an area that is so similar to an open outdoor space, does not change it into hukaf ladira at all. Well, I mean, we've got other things that seem to show that that's not true. How about this? Tashma. Let's take a look at this case. A guy spends Shabbos out on a hill. And this hill is 10 tefachim high, and it's 4 amos up until a full Beit Sa'ataim on top. And that gives him the right to carry in there, and it makes it an enclosed space for him, because the hill, because of good asik, utilizes the mechitzas of the hill itself to be a perfectly kosher rishus hayachid. I mean, since obviously it wasn't made for that purpose, so therefore you only have until Beit Sa'ataim. Or suppose you live inside of a indentation in the ground. So it's 10 tefachim deep. And it's also from 4 amos up until a Beit Sa'ataim, also all your space. Suppose you find yourself in a field in which the middle area of the field was actually harvested, and then you're surrounded all by these beautiful waving grains. Must be a field, a barley field, right? A barley field. All right, so you've got all of these waving grains of the shibboleths all around. What a lovely way to spend your Shabbos, assuming the weather's good. So the idea over there is you've got also from Arba Amot to Beit Sa'ataim, and then you can carry in that whole area. And what's more, it also counts as your enclosed space for Shabbos, which means that the tchum does not begin at the point that you start walking. The tchum begins at the end. So if you're on the eastern side of this area and you're going to be walking out 2,000 amas from the western side, that's perfectly okay. So you can, you don't count that first part, because that's all within the house, so to speak. That's all your mokum shvisa. But the area outside starts the 2,000 amos of your tchum Shabbos only there. Now, how do you explain that? I mean, according to Rav Acha bar Yaakov, fields of waving grain. How do you explain waving grain as being a correct mechitza? The very fact that it's waving means that it's not a correct mechitza. I guess we'll have to say the same thing. Now, so all of the cases that we had, according to Rav Acha bar Yaakov, we've got no choice. We have to be talking about when they are actually strengthened and now they are stiffened. Yeah, Darren, the whole idea of the whomping willow was based on the takeoff of the weeping willow. If they wouldn't have weeping willows, she never would have come up with whomping willows, obviously. Places that don't have weeping willows don't really understand what whomping willows are. Because, like, why a whomping? Anyway, not seriously. All right. What's the story of weeping willows in South Africa? I don't remember seeing any weeping willows. You do have weeping willows. Okay, so then that means...
You did see them at the Val.
Yeah? Okay, gosh.
I'll have to show you the picture.
Yeah, okay. I take it back.
You didn't drink that much to me.
We did, actually. All right, we should try it again someday, at least the drinking part. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful, let's say, Shabbos. Meet you tomorrow. Hinei El Yeshua, Tief Tach, V'lo Evchad. Certainly something to dream of and hope for. And Bezrat Hashem, Let's make it through the night, get together in the morning, see you all over at the Doc's house very soon, and we'll have some of those drinks. Cult of regards, everyone.